Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia.
Jeg står på et gadehjørne i Mumbai i Indien. En kæmpe millionby, og som man kan høre, så er trafikken virkelig, virkelig infernalsk. Har taxaer og har små tuk-tukker, de her trehjulede knaller, der med tag på, som dytter helt vildt, fordi de hele tiden er ved at komme i karambolage med bilerne. Og så midt i det hele, ja, så kommer der så en ko gående på gaden. Det er lidt af et vildt miljø at skulle bevæge sig i som trafikant eller fodgænger. Men det, der i virkeligheden er lidt sjovt, er, fordi på den ene side, så virker det fuldstændig gammeldags med de her tuk-tukker og køer på gaderne. Samtidig så er jeg kommet hertil med en taxa, som jeg tilkaldte via en Uber-app. Og samme Uber-app kan jeg også bruge til at tilkalde en af de her tuk-tukker. Fordi ligesom alle mulige andre millionbyer i verden, så ligger der sådan et digitalt lag hen over den her by. Og alle er jo faktisk på nettet med deres mobiltelefoner. Og det får mig til at tænke på et interview, jeg lavede på Techfestivalen i København for et stykke tid siden med Payal Arora, der er professor på Rotterdams Universitet, hvor hun er digital antropolog, og hun beskæftiger sig faktisk med, hvad den næste milliard mennesker, der kommer på internettet, de kommer til at bruge det til.
I'm Payal Arora. I'm a professor at Erasmus University Rotterdam, and I'm a digital anthropologist, which basically means that I study how people perceive and use technologies in their everyday lives.
And you have written a book about the next billion people entering the internet.
Absolutely. So it's the book called Next Billion Users with Harvard Press, and it's really about how people, particularly in low-income settings outside the West, have been using digital internet, digital technologies for the last decade. So that's really an accumulation of my experiences over this time, and to basically sort of chalk a pathway of how will technology look like given this huge infusion of a new kind of digital demographic into our imagination and into our day-to-day lives.
So this next billion, who are they, where do they live, and what do they want from the internet?
So, this next billion is basically substantively young. So we're talking about 36% of the population. We're talking about 86% of them live outside the West in many low-income countries and low-income communities. And there is definitely more male than female. And in some areas, there's astoundingly a huge gender divide. And that's, and we can go more into it. But that is a fact, as it's a very male sphere in many parts of it. And more importantly is they live often in informal settlements, low-income contexts, which are often deemed as illicit, illegal. And so in some sense, many of them are criminal by default. And that's worth keeping in mind, right, while you start to understand their motivations of why they're using the way they do, what their concerns and privacy are, and, their aspirations.
Who are these people? If you should paint a picture of one of these, who would it be? What would they look like?
So, for example, it could be, teenagers in a favela in Brazil, for example, right? And they often live in a very sort of monitored space. These favelas are basically informal settlements, which the government doesn't recognize often. And this is a very typical state of the art in developing countries. We're talking about 1 billion people in the world today live in these kind of settlements, which is invisible to the state and the market, because they consider it too high risk. And that's going to double by 2 billion by 2030. And that's because of the growing digital and growing global inequality, right? So what's a typical user look like is, firstly, there's no typical user, obviously. It depends on, you need to see how to slice them, right? So are we talking about teenagers in these low-income contexts, which often, if you look at a Brazilian teenager in a poor area, they are very much concerned about interpersonal surveillance. What I mean is, the often it's run by drug lords, right, who are providing them the day-to-day governance structures like water, protection also in exchange for silence or cooperation. So, because you have the pacification police in Brazil who is constantly monitoring every move, and they are kind of sort of militarized, right, to control the violence. So here you have these teenagers who have to navigate a thick space of, watching not to say the wrong things on Facebook, for example, which will piss off the drug lords, not to say the wrong things to piss off the police, not to say the wrong things to piss off their moms, and to be able to even date, right? Because a lot of single mothers are taking care of the family. And that's a very common phenomenon, is like teenage pregnancy, right? So that's the slice of life I'm talking about. Often they're living in joint families in India, for example. And that's a different perception. It's less about violence and more about cultural norms. Like, caste. Like, are you socializing with the right kind of caste, Are you socializing with the right kind of groups, right? And so they are less concerned about government surveillance. And they're more concerned about, also religious dynamics, So there are different factors that come into play depending on which context you look at. But the common thread here is that they are more concerned about the surveillance that is closest to them, that is most tangible, that's most visceral to them, because they live it on a day-to-day life. They can see these people who run the space, who run these communities, right? They see their parents who control their everyday lives. I mean, think about it. If you're a teenager, regardless of whether you're poor or rich, what do you care so much about is you want to discover who you are, right? You want to rebel in some way. You're resisting in some way, and that is a common thread. Whether you're some kid in Boston or you're a kid in a favela, you want to be seen and heard. You want to curate your profiles. You want to look cute online. You want people to like your funny jokes, right? And they are going out of their way to be visible and heard because, they're otherwise deemed so invisible by so many institutions and people that even more so they're rebelling and saying, yeah, I know it's at high risk. And I think one of the best examples is look what's happening in Saudi Arabia. A huge young population who's taken to Twitter. Twitter is very popular out there. And Saudi Arabia ranks one of the top in Twitter users worldwide. And it is a fascinating landscape of very active, engaged, entertained sort of population. Even the imams are going to it because they know that, hey, we need to entertain our demographic because it's a pretty competitive sphere amongst these imams. So they're like funny. It's almost like stand-up comedian imams, right? It's like, yes, like religion in a nutshell, for digestible for this young Saudi public. And, they have a great sense of humor. And, it makes sense, right? Humor is a phenomenal coping mechanism, particularly when you're facing these very adverse, formidable conditions, which you and I are not used to and cannot even imagine. So, there's a really rich tapestry of user behavior, which is explained by these contexts. But we should not forget that these are, either teenagers or they're women. And there's a sort of common thread based on those kind of parameters over and above class, for example, which we tend to over-exoticize as, Jesus, if they're poor, they must be completely different from us in such ways that we cannot even comprehend. And that's really not true.
It's I'm just wondering, because they are now tapping into a global network. But what you're talking about here is sort of a local social context that they find themselves in, even though they're on the global internet.
Yeah, so just like us, right? We don't have one type of role that we play in society. We have multiple roles. We play something, I'm Indian when it suits me. I'm Irish when it suits me. I am Dutch when it suits me because I live in Amsterdam. I mean, I'm whatever it suits me based. I'm a professor. I'm not, you know. So we play these roles to fit into certain kind of groups, certain kind of communication patterns. You know, we make certain kinds of jokes, and it makes sense that they do the same. So here's a fascinating study is BBC did a sort of global study about who considers themselves a global citizen. And it turned out that many people in, say, Europe, like Germany, less than 30% consider themselves a global citizen. So on the other hand, a lot of these populations in the global south, like, you know, Philippines, Vietnam, India, many parts of Africa, consider themselves very much a global citizen. We're talking as high as 80%. And I'm pretty sure a lot of them haven't left their communities. You know, when I was doing research in the Himalayas, what was foreign land to someone in a town in Almora, which is in the Himalayas, was Delhi, the city. Because it was a major thing to go to the city, if at all, right? Just to put things in perspective. So, you know, it's also this idea that the reason why they claim to be a global citizen is, of course, they're consuming all kinds of stuff on the internet. Now they're online, right? So they, you know, who is a role model in India? The number one is Bill Gates. That must say something to you, right? So it's a cosmopolitan sphere for them. And yet they are sort of proud of where they are from. You know, often they even own their context. They don't want to, you know, there's a lot of dignity driving. They say, yeah, okay, I'm from a poor community, but you know what? And they even have this sort of hashtag Valero, like my identity name and their community name next to it. So I'm from this poor context, deal with it, and we look how resilient we are, and this is how we roll. So there is this interesting play of I'm deeply local and I'm proud, and I'm very global because I'm like a Bill Gates. I, you know, listen to, you know, Hollywood music and, you know, and even like, say, Peruvians listen to Bollywood music. So it's not a sort of an American centricism, right? It's a sort of a, when I talk about cosmopolitanism, it's like K-pop in China. So there is that sort of a consumption pattern which we need to recognize. And that is, again, a very common thread, which prevails across board, isn't it?
Sometimes when we talk about technology being introduced in low-income countries, we talk about how they will leapfrog with technology because they use mobile phones instead of computers and so on. And we hear about how they will use it for scanning the market if they have grains or some kinds of vegetables and so on. They will use it for their everyday life. But what you're describing here is sort of a consumption which is about music and movies and pornography even. So is that the most important factor for people going online in low-income countries?
Look, definitely there's this huge momentum when new technologies get introduced in these contexts is that surely because they are struggling, that these tools are going to be able to help them leapfrog their way into socioeconomic mobility, particularly because they have so many profound barriers that are holding them down, right? And the intent often is good. And that comes from governments, it comes from aid agencies, but it's constantly flawed because we have a history of proof that technologies by themselves are not going to be a fixer for these situations. Because firstly, that you need to fix the institutions around you. You need to strengthen them. You need to get rid of corruption. You need to reform them in meaningful ways. So I'll give you a more concrete example. There's a push that farmers should check crop prices, right? And that was a major thing, by the way. There was even a movement called eChao Pal Initiative in India. Or, like, for example, Microsoft launched the digital greens for these sort of emerging economies. And basically, it was like farmers around the world can check crop prices and help negotiate, you know, and be more empowered to negotiate and get the right prices for their crops. Good idea, except that if you have a fixed market where it doesn't matter what information you have, I'm going to tell you, well, too bad. This is the price you're going to pay me. Otherwise, get lost. And you know what? They can't afford to argue, because for them to take their produce elsewhere, their produce will rot away. So they're going to lose that produce because they can only afford one trip from their village to the what they call the mandis in India, or basically a local meeting place with the dealers, right? And there's a lot of price fixing. So there's a limit to access to information to, you know, encounter and overcome these barriers. So, and this is the same thing with healthcare. Sure, you can check healthcare. So women can check healthcare so they can, like, be more caring towards their, you know, children and enable them to be in the right direction. But what's the point of information if you don't have access to the right medicines, the right doctors, the right, you know, services? You know, so it really comes down to that, you know, they've actually told me in the field saying, yeah, basically you're telling me that I should just learn up more and more on how helpless I am, right? Great. I'm just going to feel even more shitty that I'm going to go there and I know what the real price is and what I'm actually paying. So thanks a lot for that enlightenment, right? And I get that. So what do? They use it for actually what works for them is they are stuck in extraordinarily dehumanizing jobs. Sometimes they're stuck as in the traffic, right? Being an auto rickshaw driver or a tuk-tuk driver in the Philippines or whatnot. And, you know, if you go to any of these contexts, the traffic is a killer. And, like, you're sitting there. And do you know how mobile phones really took off? It's because of this nonstop listening to radio. And the mobile industry very quickly learned is that for us to have 100% penetration rate, which, by the way, they do in many of these contexts, which is an astounding feat. Computers didn't succeed with that. Tablets didn't succeed with that. And mobile phones were the first demand-driven technology, which won the hearts and minds of these people because it helped these people cope with their, you know, everyday moments of frustration and, you know, angst, sitting for 3 hours in the traffic, and then they could listen to radio shows, talk shows, educate themselves a little, you know, about discussions going on. They couldn't read a paper. And so the radio feature and the long-lasting battery, these were the two winners that actually allowed the mobile phone to take off. And today, in 2016, basically, the data disruption that took place because of the introduction of new data plans by initiatives like Jio, which is a sort of a telecom initiative by the billionaire Ambani in India, has made data the cheapest in the world in India. 20 cents per GB versus, say, €6 in Europe, $15 in the United States. And that is seriously disrupting the market. I mean, really, in a way, you know, we should be really thankful that the market has been so responsive. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I mean is that, you know, the legacy infrastructures that we are used to, you know, when we talk about institutions, we are quite spoiled. We have an innate trust in our social institutions. We can be critical about it with, you know, at a safe space, right? We are not going to get persecuted for that. And we do get a delivery of services by educating ourselves about what we can demand as consumers, as citizens, you know, as just, you know, human beings of what's right and wrong, right? But these populations don't have that kind of privilege. And so, of course, they take to what they have control over is leisure. This is their only leisure economy. And they're going to hold on to it because it reminds them that they are human.
So just like every other teenager on the planet, they would look at a sort of like, I don't know, music videos or whatever.
Yeah, so in some sense, they are everyday teenagers. In other ways, they are taking extraordinary risks and possibly paying extraordinary price for doing something which is very mundane, like a girl in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia who decides to get together with her other girlfriends, get into her room, and do a little YouTube fashion show and put it online because she's like a teenager and wants a little attention and she can't display these fashions in public. It's illegal. The moral police will crack down on it. And so, you know, but she's hoping her brothers don't get to see it. hoping her father doesn't get to see it. And there's a high likelihood her father won't see it because he's not, like, on those shows. But her brother could, right? And the risk she's taking for that, which is often even, punishable by death sometimes. It's a very, very stringent honor code in these a lot of these communities. That is which distinguishes these people from the typical teenagers. So their actual actions resonate in terms of, yeah, this is a typical teenager. But behind these sort of mundane actions comes a deep amount of activism through their, you know, everyday activity. You know, and that's something which is so profound, so incomprehensible to us, right? If you're following the news, I was, you know, devastated to read, you know, these honor killings are gut-wrenching because a typical girl, like these two girls in Pakistan, were clapping at a wedding and singing a song, right? Along at a wedding, and they were videotaped, and they were killed because they were shamed. They shamed their family, right? You read these incidents again and again. A girl did a selfie with her fiancé, but it was before the wedding, so they both got killed, right? And this is in another Middle Eastern context. There's so much about, you know, honor killings tied with online exposure of women, what is considered indecent. And that indecency is extraordinarily mundane to us, that it would not even occur to us that that would be a thing. And the price you pay is often death. So, you know, if you really want to think about how to really enable these populations, we need to really have a concerted effort into pushing for gender rights, you know, in a genuine way of enforcement. It's not about laws, because a lot of these honor killings, they don't get punished, you know, a lot of people don't get held accountable. Worse yet, the victims get to be, if they're raped, get to be blamed, right? And why is that connected to technology? Is because, for example, Pornhub, which has been possibly, like, pornography sites, of course I bring up Pornhub because it's one of the most dominant, is the single most powerful entry point to the mobile phone and the internet. Because anyone who's a newbie, the person who's coming into contact with the internet for the first time, is often coming via pornography. And that, you know, if many people remember how they actually got hooked on the internet, well, you know, it was pornography in many regards. But then, of course, you broaden your behaviors and activities, right? And Pornhub has a tremendous responsibility, too. In one way, of course, they're providing us this access to, you know, sexual needs, aspirations, the types of sexual activity that you can imagine. But because you were talking about conservative communities that will never even talk about sex, you have no avenue where you can even bring it up. And so it has become, by default, the educator, right, for all these teenagers. On the other hand, revenge porn is so dangerous because when it goes viral, these women, literally, their lives are at stake. And they have to be so, they better come up with a better response than, like, it takes weeks for them to respond through email. They make it as hard as possible. So this is what I mean. They need to become much more accountable because we're talking about a lot is at stake across board.
You talk a lot about social control, which is sort of the local social control. But what about government surveillance and government control when you talk about digital media and these new markets for the internet?
Yeah, so, you know, in terms of government control, and first, when we think about technology and government control, pretty much what people nowadays think about is social credit scores in China, for example. In fact, China has overtaken our imagination in a sort of an alarm bell of let's not get to that point. And I think there is a sort of a, you know, unfair framing in the media about China. Not because I'm defending China because of all the activities, not especially what's going on right now with Hong Kong. But let's be fair, right? What has happened in China in the last decades is nothing short of a miracle. They have brought millions of people out of poverty and come up with this brilliant idea of how to give access to microloans to people who don't have assets. Look, I mean, it's always relative to something. These are not absolute values. And so we're talking about a communist history, right, where people didn't have assets, didn't have an accumulation of wealth, which has moved to a sort of a capitalistic, Chinese capitalistic system, right? We're talking about banks, traditional banks, that have failed us time and again and are in many ways as toxic an institution in, you know, in alienating 4 billion of the world's population. And they keep getting away with it. We keep bailing them out, even though they are highly irresponsible. And then, you know, they basically find these users too high risk and refuse to cater to them. So what does China do? It says, well, okay, so we can't force these banks to give them loans. What we're going to do is, it's all about trust, right? Trustworthiness. You need to build some kind of trust so you can get some kind of loan. So let's help these users build trust and have control through their activities online, you know, and also not just activities online, like their little payment behaviors. Like, are they paying their bills on time, like their utility bills? Or are they like, you know, do they have a job? Or are they like taking care of their children, or et cetera, et cetera? And this builds up with points, which means then you can get microloans. And this has literally in the shortest amount of time historically brought the most number of people out of poverty. And why don't we also talk about that, right? And if you look closely, you know, there's such a hypocrisy between the West, you know, framing and how they frame it in such an Orwellian manner when it comes to China, but not when it comes to the way they practice it. Because predictive analytics is being used by banks scraping social media accounts in order to give loans. Healthcare insurances in the U.S. are denying people. There's all kinds of nefarious activities. They're just not like, the corporations are more in control than the government. That's the difference. It's an tech oligarchy, right? I mean, so, and let's face the fact is that it really suits them to dehumanize and demonize China, because the fact is they are way behind China in many technologies, like the 5G war, right? Huawei is way ahead. And there's no actual evidence that Huawei actually did something wrong. And so the U.S. has lost all moral high ground. And if anyone has evidence against a country, we need to sanction the United States because of Snowden revelations. Why don't we talk about that? Why don't we talk about them as an Orwellian state going and imposing their will? Because look at the alternative. I talked to a number of NGOs in Latin America, and they said they're not only being pressured to give up Huawei, which is much cheaper, more effective, more efficient, but they're forced to take on AT&T. We somehow missed that equation, right? Because, of course, we don't ask, so who's going to take the place of Huawei? AT&T. I would rather be shot than take AT&T. It's a terrible service. I mean, I lived in the United States. I wouldn't want to like have AT&T even then. Why would I want it now? They are so way behind. And this is what I mean. It's sort of like you can't be the leaders, global leaders of, you know, advocating for globalization of technology and a sort of a global public commons when it suits you, you know, from the goodness of the Silicon Valley. And then when you decide to get very protectionist, when you're lagging behind, it doesn't work that way because people see through that. So, you know, there is this problem is that, yes, China has the social credit score. It is, of course, imposing upon especially certain kinds of populations, because we have to understand it's not one China, it's many Chinas, and different kinds of populations are experiencing this in different ways. The typical middle-class Chinese citizen in, you know, Shenzhen and Beijing and, you know, Shanghai have a very kind of much more freedom, you know, because they're in particular zones than, say, the Uyghurs, right? So it depends on who you are. So it's not that they are stupid. They actually fundamentally are experiencing the internet in different ways, which are less intrusive, more freedom, and they have seen a change in their lives. Better governance, more accountability, working systems, right? And governance really matters. So you can have things running on time. You can pay your bills. It's a sort of one-stop-for-shop ecosystem which has made their lives fundamentally much easier. depends on who you are. So it is not a surprise that like 70% of the population is very enthusiastic about it, because they're not naive. They're just experiencing a different internet, right? Different regulations. And China is very good at that, is like moderating it, because they're savvy with knowing that you need to have a sort of a balance between different populations. So, yeah, I mean, I really look at, we need to see also the agency aspect is, people are looking at this as saying, look, we've always been under a surveillance state. You know, in during communist times, they had dossiers, like the kind of Stasi regime, right? Like you had dossiers on your, what you got, including what you got in terms of grades in school, to everything, like, right? The government had like a file on you. So this kind of, being accustomed to being documented is a long practice, okay? And even with the hukou system, which is basically moderating between the mobility between the rural and the urban Chinese, it is a requirement to display and, you know, disclose a lot of your documents, your behaviors, etc., to get the permits. So, you know, we have a legacy of that. So when they look at the system of the social credit score, you know what the average person sees in China is, at last I have some control. I can game the system, because I can put shit on social media that the Chinese government likes, so I can game it and move ahead. I mean, wouldn't this be more of an agency? So shouldn't we be celebrating that more? So this is what I mean, is the hypocrisy of it all and the sort of moral uprightness saying, oh my God, look at China and look at the people. Why are they like not understanding? You know, it's either like very condescendingly, they don't know what's at stake. Yes, they do. They just know that, yeah, well, we know our privacy is not going to like happen in terms of from the government. But as long as they are giving us other kinds of, you know, facilities, governance, you know, and other kinds of affordances that makes my life easier, my children's life easier, roof over my head, I have prosperity in many ways, then I am willing to tolerate this a little more and maybe even game it a bit, like, you know, and there's something to be said about that. So I'm not defending, you know, I noticed that if you talk at all, even giving any kind of defense for China, it means that you're basically saying that, oh, then I'm a pro-Chinese, or I'm a pro. The sort of notion of pro-West versus pro-East is such a sort of divisive and naive position to take on. We should be really looking at, you know, these systems and why people are genuinely doing what they're doing, and not from a sort of condescending, naive, or morally upright position.
If you compare this to this biometric system you have in India, which is a democracy, so it's different than China, could you sort of see some parallels?
Yeah, so, you know, India has gained a lot by being called the world's biggest democracy, but it is also acting in ways which are much more similar to China, because they both fundamentally are welfare states. Majority of their populations are still poor, right? And we keep forgetting that with China is that they, I mean, of course, they're upwardly rising. I mean, they've moved quite a bit. But they're both relatively poor countries. And so when, you know, it's like when you think about welfare in the West, we intrude on their lives, right? We ask far more from them. And we go to their houses, we check on them and all. A lot of their privacy is taken in exchange for welfare benefits. And that's like not the norm. But when a state is a welfare state, whether it's India or China, they have the same kinds of criteria. It's because a lot of populations, the more they become dependent on a government, the government believes that it is a development state, which means that privacy is a luxury. It's something on the side, which is, by the way, not a position one should take, not because of anything else. It's simply, obviously, one is it's a fundamental right, but most importantly, just on purely practical purposes, it's like when you lose the trust of a citizen, their behavior is going to be irrational. If they don't trust you, you may have the best system to genuinely help them, and they're not going to get on board. And if they don't get on board, it's been a waste of an effort. And you can see that from like policies of the, you know, like forced sterilization policies in India in the 80s, where they wanted to have one child only. So they were forcing people to sterilize themselves. And so that had a huge backlash against decades of trying to educate and, you know, these people on why family planning matters. Because people absolutely didn't trust that. And now you see that in a number of poor contexts is that they think they have a deep distrust, you know, even with the most well-intended, you know, actors coming into their communities. Because they're like, yeah, what do you want out of me, right? The moment you lose trust, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, India or China, you will lose them. So interestingly, there's a lot of trust in the Chinese system, right, by the average citizen, because they see the delivery of services, of everyday governance. And I think this ties to a bigger question of what's going on right now, which we are all very concerned about, is democracy. Like, you know, you hear these things, Facebook killing democracy, tech killing democracy, and blah, blah. And actually, what is really at stake is that, you know, India and China are both, you know, it's not about privacy. It's not the as much as the right to be given the human dignity of day-to-day living. So in India, you if you don't get a roof over your head, you're not able to provide for your children. Farmers are killing themselves because they just feel complete shame that they're unable to support their families. That, you know, it is there's more hope in China because they've been enabled, right? So democracy is a very lofty ideal. Remember, it's just an ideology of the very recent times. And it means very little if you're unable to give people their day-to-day dignities. And so I think we need to keep that in mind, is that there is a reason why these sort of, you know, extremist positions are coming up in these contexts, is because democracy, again, is a luxury. And if you're going to introduce people to democracy, it's not the political loftiness. It's the ground level reality. They want to see a road fixed. They want to see more choice in like where I can sell my crops. They want to see tangible benefits than something like, oh, look, you have the choice to vote, which doesn't really matter if you don't trust the government or that the law has always been against you. If you think about law itself, you're so sort of, you know, naive about GDPR, however well-meaning, it's going to have very little impact. Why? Because legal structures also need to have enforcement measures. And, you know, delayed justice is no justice. You look around the world and few people respect the law or believe they can get justice through it. And in fact, parallel systems of justice have emerged and have been instituted, whether it's a Sharia law or, you know, there's a recent Economist article of rent a sheikh, you know, like because instead of going to the law courts in the Middle East, you actually have a sheikh negotiating for you and resolving matters which will otherwise never happen in a regular Supreme Court or regular court. So let's keep that in mind as we start to, you know, think about reforming tech, you know, and changing systems. Because the bottom line is, if you genuinely want to change tech, we need to actually have non-technological solutions for that, you know, alongside this, so, to make any kind of difference.
Ja, her hørte du Payal Arora, der altså er digital antropolog fra Universitetet i Rotterdam, og jeg mødte hende på Techfestivalen tidligere i år. Det er jo sådan, at Techtopien også udkommer på Radio 4, og i den her uge, der kan du faktisk høre en udsendelse om Big Brother Award. Det handler om kameraovervågning i Danmark. En pris, som gik til statsminister Mette Frederiksen, som hun formodentlig ikke var så glad for, men en af hendes partifæller har jeg fået i studiet til at debattere med en af dommerne, som har uddelt prisen, og det kan du altså høre på radio4.dk.
Altså, jeg tror ikke, der er så meget tvivl om, at vi er, hvis vi ser tilbage de sidste 20 eller 30 år i det danske samfund, eller i de andre EU-samfund også, så er der en øgning af den statslige overvågning, og også af den kommercielle overvågning, for den sags skyld. Så du ser, du har set en bevægelse, og især siden 2001, som hele tiden går i retning af øget overvågning. Så man kan sige, altså med prisen, jeg er faktisk også med i en anden dommerkomité, som uddeler en databeskyttelsespris i januar. Mm. Og du kan sige, det er sådan en meget positiv pris, fordi den siger, hvilke gode kræfter i samfundet har gjort meget for at fremme retten til privatliv og databeskyttelse i det forgangne år. Så det her, altså den modsatte pris, den siger, hvor synes vi, der især er taget et skridt i den forkerte retning i forhold til overvågning af borgere?
Jeppe Bruus, retspolitisk ordfører for Socialdemokratiet. Som vi hørte her i klippet, så var der ikke mødt nogen op for at modtage blomsterne og prisen. Hvad tænker du, når du hører den her omgang?
Jamen, jeg er ked af, at de ikke har inviteret mig.
Så vil du vil godt være kommet.
Ja, så vil jeg være kommet.
Den podcast, du lige har hørt om næste milliard mennesker på internettet, ja, den kan du finde mere information om på tektopia.dk. Du kan også deltage i debatten på Tektopia Backstage på Facebook. Så kan du skrive til mig på henriksnabelag@tektopia.dk, og du kan følge os på Twitter på @tektopia.dk. Inden vi slutter helt af, skal vi også lige have en lille hilsen fra Ingeniørens podcast Transformator.
Vi står over for et trafikkaos i rummet, når mere end 40.000 satellitter bliver sendt op i samme afstand fra jorden inden for de kommende år. Det handler om det globale kapløb om at komme først med internet til alle ude fra rummet. Men lige nu her handler det mest om trafiksikkerhed og vigepligt og forsikringer, når atmosfæren kommer til at ligne Lyngbyvejen på en dårlig dag. Hør om det. Og hør i ugens Transformator, hvordan Danmarks areal i denne uge blev forøget med et område på størrelse med Jylland. Og fik jeg sagt, at vi krydder også med en opsang for Edward Snowden.
Ja, det var alt, hvad der var i Tektopia i denne her uge. Husk, at vi kommer på podcast hver eneste mandag, og i æderen på Radio 4 søndag kl. 13.05 hver eneste søndag. På genhør. Tektopia.
Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia.